Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Today, I welcome Val Garver, who is a medievalist at Northern Illinois University, specializes in the life of women and children in the medieval period. So she's the perfect person to talk about Arya's second POV chapter in A Clash of Kings. Then I talk House of the Dragon with medieval historian Ian McInnes. Okay, without further ado, here is Dr. Valerie Garver. What's your relationship with this book, A Clash of Kings?
Well, I first read the book after I watched the first season of the TV show Game of Thrones. And that was because I hate spoilers or having something given away to me before I either see or read it. And so after I watched the first season, I kind of got hooked and I thought, I'm going to read the books so that no one then tells me something and messes up for me so I can experience it firsthand via the books.
Right.
So that was how I first came to the books.
Now, were you already a professional historian interested in the medieval world, or like where does this find you in terms of your career?
It was when I was well into my career as a medieval historian.
Okay.
So yeah, that's kind of how I came to it. I also, in part, thought when I saw the show, like, oh, my students are going to ask about this. Because over the years, there's been various books or movies, and students, you can kind of predict, students are going to ask about this.
Right.
And so it was another reason to kind of read the books, because sometimes that helps if I read the things or watch the things that they're interested in, too.
Right. Yeah. So you saw the show, and then you picked up the book, and then you just kept reading. Is that
correct?
Is that basically what happened?
Exactly.
All right. So I'm assuming you did get questions from students, and maybe that spurred your interest in doing a full seminar related to Game of Thrones.
It did. Yeah, exactly. It was kind of a funny thing about the first season of the show is as I watched it, I thought, wow, this is kind of amazing. There are bits of it that feel more medieval than like movies or other kinds of shows that are allegedly about the Middle Ages, but don't really get things right. But had parts of it definitely had a very medieval feel. And then I remember talking to colleagues who said the same thing, you know, other medievalists, like, oh, isn't it funny? And we would all pick up on these certain scenes that we thought were like that. And so it was funny because sometimes I started using references to the show in my regular classes. So there's a great scene from the first season in which, you know, Catelyn Stark kind of calls all the bannermen of the Tullys to arrest Tyrion. And it was a really good example of something that students sometimes I felt never quite got in class, which
is wait, let's just make sure we know what we're talking about.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
This is sort of, she's at the inn at the crossroads and Tyrion walks in and she kind of looks around the room and thinks, I bet you these guys are loyal to my father. And then she decides that she's going to call them out, you know, each by house and really kind of call them to arms, right? Is that the scene you're talking about?
Yes, that's exactly it. And I would even say, I don't even think she just like suspects they would. It's like she knows that they will come to her.
Yeah.
Like she just knows. Yeah. And she knows how to do it kind of formally. And I like that scene because I say to the students, you know how I'm always telling you that politics was personal in the Middle Ages and it was based on familial connections and like connections of friendship and bonds of loyalty. I'm like, it's like that scene. And they would all go, oh, yeah. And I found out a couple other colleagues were using that same scene. So a student came up to me afterwards and she said, oh, have you ever thought about teaching a class on Game of Thrones? And I said, oh, I don't know. I don't know anything about TV. And she said, okay. And then, but it's funny, she had a class with another professor on campus who's was an expert, still is an expert, really, in long-form television. Mm. It's Jeff Chown, who's over in our communications department.
Okay.
And she had a class with him, and he mentioned something in this class, which was about long-form television, about how he liked the show Game of Thrones. He thought it was quite good example of that kind of television. But he said, I just don't feel like I can teach it because I don't know that much about like the Middle Ages or fantasy or anything. And so she said to him, oh, you know, my other professor, she said, I don't know anything about TV. And he and I happened to be on a committee at the time together. So we ended up talking when we were on this committee. I remember in this committee room, we were like, we should teach a class. And so
you're like, you got a lot of chocolate and I've got a lot of peanut butter over here.
Exactly.
I wonder what we could do with these two items. All right, that's fantastic. So so I just a little interlude here. I'm assuming that for the same reasons you've been watching House of the Dragon.
I have been watching it, yeah.
All right. I'm just kind of curious your general impressions of that show.
At first, I got to be honest, I didn't really like it very much. That first episode sort of infuriated me for a variety of reasons.
Okay.
Yeah. But the show grew on me, and I kept watching it for a couple reasons. One is that I'm still probably going to teach that Game of Thrones class again, and I need to know like what might drive students into the class. And I thought that maybe the show is more likely to get them interested.
More current.
Also, I'll be honest, I love the dragons, like in the show, the way they portray them. It's really, they're really fun. And so I was like, I definitely liked that part. So I kept watching and it did grow on me after a while. And I thought, oh, this is kind of better than I thought. But I had to like to put my finger on what it is that makes me like it less than the original Game of Thrones show is.
Yeah.
I think it's because I was never a Team Targaryen person.
Right.
It was never the side I was rooting for.
Right.
I always saw Daenerys Targaryen as being kind of a wicked person in a way. In addition to being, I mean, I understood all the ways in which she was very cool and, you know, in some ways fought for social justice, but I always thought, what a high cost. And so I was never that into the Targaryens. And I guess what I miss is like that depth in the original show of different houses. You got a little bit more of that. But I think the thing that I like least about the show is the level of violence without the kind of running commentary in the background about a critique of the violence that we got in that first show. And I think that's because it's Targaryen focused. I think it's just the nature of the source material.
And I think that they might try to do that in upcoming seasons because I feel like they're going to, I mean, this first season tried to cover what, like 2 decades or something.
Yeah, it was kind of that was a difficult task.
So I feel like now that you're really focusing in on the actual Civil War, it feels like you're going to have to deal with the consequences of the violence more. At least that's my hope.
So.
That's my hope.
Yeah. And I have to say, the last episode I thought was one of the best ones. And I thought it did start to do that a little bit. Like the cost, right, to Rhaenyra of losing her son.
Mm-hmm.
And like I also thought it was interesting what they said about the dragons, about whether can you control your dragons or not. I thought that was well played out too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, I'm very hopeful. And I also thought that first season, that was very tricky to cover that much time. So it did feel by the end of it, like, I think that's another reason why maybe I didn't like it as much, is it felt like a setup. Whereas the first season of Game of Thrones felt like a real story, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so. I totally know what you mean. I feel like I'm with you. I feel like these Targaryens are hard to root for sure.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm kind of watching this show like I would watch, sometimes Scorsese will focus in on an interesting personality that's only going to spiral into darkness. And you kind of have to be interested in the storytelling. Like, you're not really rooting for, you know, this character to fall into depravity, but at the same time, it's kind of interesting to watch. So I feel like I'm watching this show kind of like I watched Breaking Bad or something like that.
Yeah, I can see that. I liked Breaking Bad too.
But
the characters are still more sympathetic in Breaking Bad. But we'll see.
Yeah, maybe so.
I'm hopeful.
I loved House of the Dragon. I do feel like there are certain elements of the original series that were not in that show. And I feel like one of the great feats of that first show is to show what happens in between point A and point B. Like, for instance, in this chapter we're covering today, Arya's on the road.
Yeah.
And it just takes a long time to get from one place to another. And antics will ensue when you're on the road, you know? Like, anything could happen on the road. You could, you know, you could have a dispute between children that could actually have real-world political consequences, like we saw with Joffrey and Arya in the first book.
Yeah.
When you got a dragon to fly around, which is, don't get me wrong, super cool. They're dragons, right? But when you got a dragon to fly around, there's no what's going to happen along the road that's going to complicate the narrative. So I do miss from time to time a chapter like this where, I don't know, maybe there's 50 miles covered, but a lot's going to happen in those 50 miles.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think that's one of the other reasons. It kind of draws on another kind of global reason why I've kind of preferred the first series is probably because it did feel more medieval. And that passage of time and the difficulty of communication and how long it takes to get information from point A to point B, that's quite medieval, actually. Yes. It's a big medieval problem.
That's right.
I think you're exactly right. In House of the Dragon, it happens really fast. The communication seems quicker. To me, it seems like more of a modern show, maybe. You know, I haven't completely thought this through, but to me, so far, it feels a little more early modern than medieval.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. The other thing that is missing is that, a character that you can root for. And I do feel like Arya is, in a way, spiraling into darkness, right? If we see her from this book to the end of Dance, she's absolutely on a path toward a death religion. But boy, do I ever root for her. I mean, I'm always rooting for Arya no matter what. She doesn't have the Targaryen problem. And, you know, I guess it's hard not to root for Arya. There's just so much to love about her. But I feel like, let's jump right in, shall we? Let's talk about
definitely.
Arya. Okay. Arya and 30 men continue north as they watch refugees march south along the King's Road. At the inn, several travelers scold Yorn for bringing his men into harm's way. Arya hears rumors about battles and Robb and wolves. When she is sent outside for speaking out of turn, Arya meets Jack and Hagar, who asks for beer. She sees gold cloaks sent by the queen. The queen's men ask after a boy in their company. Arya, who is now hiding with Gendry, whispers that they are looking for her. When swords are drawn, it seems that the men are actually after Gendry. Yoren puts a blade to the throat of one of the men, takes his sword, and sends the gold cloaks away. He tells Arya and Gendry that they will be riding coursers from now on. So, Valerie Garver, I'm wondering what you bring to the table today. I've asked you for an observation and or a question.
Yeah. I guess my observation would be that this chapter is really great at sort of highlighting the children in the chapter as children. Mm. And I really quite like that about it. They don't come across as having too much adult motivation, which I think sometimes there are points in the books where, you know, effectively like adolescents or children are given a kind of like motivation that seems hard to believe, like kind of a follow through that doesn't entirely make sense. Hmm. But at other times, like they're very well written. And I think this is a chapter where they're well written. And I would say, like, as a historian of medieval childhood, it's a particularly interesting chapter because you're seeing children who are in this chapter who are the have nots.
Right.
And they've really had hard lives. And I sort of like all the different ways that their kind of differing backgrounds are sort of highlighted and what those backgrounds cause them to do in certain situations, especially the situations of stress, like, you know, kind of Arya's reaction. But like just for example, to focus on Arya, when she says, you know, she thinks about her dad and Sansa. Mm-hmm. She says, oh, it made me feel so sad. You know, like she's thinking back on it. And
right.
there's this just immediate response of this, it's painful, and kind of moving on to other topics, right? And I can see that as a like a pretty natural kind of response for a child, but also I feel like it also kind of highlights where her character is going. You know, she's had this wonderful childhood at Winterfell, yeah. and now she's lost it, and she has this kind of nostalgia, but pained nostalgia for the past. And it's sort of like she has to move on and look for something else. And what examples does she have around her, right?
Yeah, I kind of feel like with Arya, and I guess this would be the case for almost anyone who's experiencing grief. It's like, it kind of sneaks up on you. But then yeah. you've got other concerns. You've got your daily concerns. And of course, Arya's concerns are immediate and in severe, right?
Oh, yeah.
She absolutely has to keep up with this guys. She's around men who are legit dangerous. Mm-hmm. And on top of the, these gold cloaks show up, she's got to decide if, is Jaqen a friend or is he an enemy? Can I trust this guy? You know, her mind is occupied, right? And yet, there's still that little moment where she kind of allows herself to experience the sadness, but immediately she's distracted again. I think that, I don't know if that's necessarily a feature necessarily of childhood, but I totally find it believable for her.
Yeah, I guess I would say it makes me feel like it's more of a child sense, because so many adults ruminate on their grief.
Sure.
And kind of understand it in a kind of broader context. Yeah. And I think it does a good job of like suggesting that for a child, like if this is her first real experience of losing someone super close to her, which, I mean, obviously, like she was upset when Jory was killed. Mm. But and I mean, that's someone that she knew from her childhood, but to have like a close relative like that, that would be a first experience for her. Yeah. And I think it would be hard for her to contextualize it. But I also think you're right. Like this immediate, like, how is she just going to get by? I think that's a very interesting aspect of the chapter. And also an interesting aspect of this book overall is what happens to the have-nots of Westeros during this time. And I think you see that so well in this chapter. And not just with the children, but with the people passing by and saying, why are you going the wrong direction? And, I think that's also like this moment where I think it's Arya notices like the grave of a child.
Mm-hmm.
That was also very, very, I thought, a nice touch, because, of course, one of the boys wants to go and take the crystal off of it. And Yoren is like, no, you can't do that. And there's a sense of this is a child's grave and someone has very lovingly buried this child, but also that people respect that. And I kind of like that aspect too of the book, that if it's drawing from kind of a medieval model, that that Martin didn't just buy into kind of the pop culture idea that, oh, these people, they wouldn't have cared about their lost children. They really do, right? Yeah. And I think that comes out here really well as well. But I also think one of her big challenges too, among them, in addition to the ones that you already mentioned, which I completely agree with, is also that she's trying to pass as a boy.
Mm-hmm.
And even though she's, definitely portrayed as kind of like a tomboy earlier in the book, one starts to realize that there's all these ways in which she can't pass, like she's having trouble passing because people start to notice she's a girl. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's like really also adding to her stress.
Absolutely. Yeah. She's like keeping that mask on must occupy a lot of her daily life, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, just the thing that she's like, I can't go and bathe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you can tell she would like to.
She
knows
she needs to, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
So I'm wondering, all right, so a lot of your research relates to medieval childhood. And I'm wondering, Arya's kind of on this cusp between, she grew up in a very wealthy family. She's very much a have and not a have not, right?
Exactly.
And yet she's kind of forced into this role where she has to either pretend to be a have not and or in many ways now she is a have not. So I'm wondering if you could maybe talk a little bit about the differences between childhood as experienced by, wealthy nobility and childhood experienced by commoners.
Yeah, I think one of the most important differences would be access to nutrition. Mm. And so there's a good amount, I would say, of literature about this, kind of trying to understand how children would have been affected by nutritional deficiencies mm. that probably would have been more or less common at certain times. And so, especially because the population would mainly have been engaged in agriculture in the Middle Ages, so many children kind of would have lived in the countryside and been very dependent on what could their families grow or what did they mm. have access to. And in some years, you know, that could have been quite good, but we have plenty of examples of famines and also of the effects of things like warfare, like what we're seeing in this chapter, that disrupted the supply of food. And one definitely gets a sense that if you're from a wealthy family, you're not going to be as concerned about getting the food that you need, nutrition that you need. And, you know, now, of course, we have a pretty good biological understanding of why that nutrition is important and mm-hmm. what it does for you. But we certainly see this also in the archaeological record. And, you know, when cemeteries, and I'm most familiar with ones from the early Middle Ages, but when they've been dug up, you can see in the bones sometimes some of the deficiencies that were there. So, for example, calcium deficiencies mm-hmm. often show up and things like that, and damage to teeth. So I'd say that is definitely one thing. And we see it here because there's definitely a concern with how are they going to find food, and people moving to find food for their children and things like this. And a suggestion also that comes up later in the books too of people starving. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I think, part of the equation too. The other thing is that I think the education would have been very different. I mean,
let me ask you about the nutrition. Oh, real quick. Yeah.
Sure. No problem.
All right. So I'm wondering what the actual physical impact would be. Would it be that commoners didn't grow as tall, didn't have the muscle mass, is it the case that because of the nutritional deficits that commoners, maybe they would be viewed as less valuable soldiers, and maybe nobility would actually have all of those physical attributes that you would look for in someone who could actually fight on the battlefield?
Yeah, I think some of those things are very hard to measure. So, for example, like muscle mass, we don't really have a good way of doing that because sure. it doesn't survive in the archaeological record. Right. And I mean, there's a long list of things I wish were described in medieval sources, but descriptions or measurements of muscle mass, definitely not in there. Mm-hmm. So that one's like a hard one. But yeah, I think it would have affected their ability to develop strong muscles. But the one thing I think that's most clear about the nutritional deficiencies is it would have made people who were not getting enough food more susceptible to disease.
Right.
That's pretty well documented. And so, you know, if you're not getting good nutrition to begin with, your body's just not able to fight off disease in the same way. Mm-hmm. I agree. I think, yes, it is possible that they were shorter, but we do not have enough overall evidence for me to say with 100% sureness, yes, that the elite tended to be taller than the non-elite. We don't know that.
Sure.
But I mean, yes, I think that's very possible because we do know that in times of famine that people simply don't grow as tall. And so that would definitely be part of it as well. In terms of being soldiers, I think that there was an understanding in the Middle Ages that the non-elite were almost like a different type of soldier than the elite, especially because the elite often had horses, and that very much set them apart.
Right.
And so I think it's a different kind of warfare. So warfare is not like an area I'm super expert in. But my sense would be that they would not necessarily have been compared in that way at that time.
Sure.
Yeah.
And we know for certain now with modern science that your physiological makeup, hunger being chief among them, absolutely does affect your mental capacities.
Oh, absolutely.
So
yes.
You were going to talk a little bit about the difference in education, and I guess opportunity is like 90% of the problem, right? But there's also the question of, you know, if you have a primary need of, you know, dictated by your hunger, are you going to learn as quickly? And the answer is probably no.
Yeah, I think that is absolutely correct. I also think just for the non-elite, that education was something different. It was a more practical education. You would probably have learned by like watching your parents mm-hmm. or other people in your community do things, or you may have been an apprentice at one point where you learn skills. It's more of a hands-on sort of education. Mm-hmm. Whereas you do would say for the elite, many of them did learn how to read. I mean, some of them probably, you know, like any group of people, like some are going to be more interested in pursuing mm-hmm. reading and learning more than others. But they would have, they had tutors and it was possible for some children to go to schools in the Middle Ages, especially boys. And especially later, we have a little bit better documentation for that. Not something that would have been so open to say someone, you know, working on a farm. Mm-hmm. That just would have been different. So different kinds of education.
Like, for instance, we have Gendry in this chapter, right?
Yeah.
Gendry.
He was an apprentice, right?
Yeah, he's an apprentice. He's learned the craft. He's learned a particular craft and learned it pretty well. Who knows if he can read? It probably isn't required for his job, right?
Yeah, hard to say, yeah.
So, and then you've got, like, in the first book, we are told that Sansa loves to read. And this is, doesn't really interest Arya that much, but she's good with numbers, we're told in the first book.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
All right, so she has some capacity there, but really what she does is she throws herself into learning the art of swordplay.
Yes, and very much in opposition. She doesn't want to do needlework like Sansa.
That's right.
Right?
That's
and that's right. A more traditional kind of educational pursuit for girls, sure. Both in the books and in the Middle Ages. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think Arya's mind has advantages that some of these other boys don't have, right?
Yes.
She's been taught to think. She's been taught by, you know, Sirio to really see. Like, don't just look. See. And I think what he means is, in that way, you know, interpret. You know, see what they don't want you to, you know, see about the situation. In this chapter, she doesn't just see the gold cloaks. She sees that the horses are lathered. In other words, they must have been riding hard and fast for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And this allows her to kind of see, like, these men may be in more of a desperate situation than you might see on the surface. And I think all of these are kind of outworkings of her education, even though we might not think of those abilities of observation as, you know, maybe something that's part of traditional education.
Yeah.
But I do think with Arya, we have this really keen mind that's emerging.
Oh, definitely. And you can also get an idea, I think, in the chapter that she just has a bigger sense of the world than those other kids, because she has that moment where she's like, oh, I wish I had a map so I could figure out like how close this is to this. Mm-hmm. And like you can see in her head, she has this idea of what does the whole of Westeros like. And she thinks in much bigger terms because she comes from the elite as well. And I think part of that is from formal education. But again, I think part of it is from the informal education that elite children would have had of being around powerful people and hearing the things they said and the way they talked about the world. That would be very different, I think, from, say, you know, one of these non-elite kids like Hapai. Like, what did he grow up hearing? It would have been really different, right?
Absolutely.
And now, you know, all these studies are really, like, I think, excellent about showing that the atmosphere that children grow up in has such an influence on their ability to engage in both formal education and to be successful in life. You know, just the sheer number of vocabulary words that a child hears, right, has this huge effect. So you can kind of see this at play as well, I think, in this chapter, this difference among the kids. And I think Gendry's a really good example because it's showing some gradations among the non-elite, right? Gendry has been an apprentice. He's been exposed to King's Landing, as opposed to some of these other kids who just seem really, they're younger and from even poorer circumstances and just seem kind of lost in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, yes. So she has an advantage in a number of ways over these boys who grew up destitute.
But
right?
In a sense, they also have an advantage that she doesn't have, which is they sort of know how to scrape by.
Right. They're kind of.
Right. And and she's having to figure it out, but they kind of know. And in a sense, like she's smart. Like she picks up on like, how are they surviving?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hear the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So you mentioned this passage. I'm just going to go ahead and read it. "It's been a bad year for wolves," volunteered a sallow man in travel-stained green cloak. "Around the God's Eye, the packs have grown bolder than anyone can remember. Sheeps, cows, dogs, it makes no matter. They kill as they like, and they got no fear of men. It's worth your life to go into those woods by night." Ah, that's more tales, and no more true than the other. "I heard the same thing from my cousin. And she's not the sort to lie," an old woman said. "She says that there's this great pack, hundreds of them, man-killers. The one that leads them is a she-wolf, a bitch from the seventh hell." "A she-wolf?" Arya sloshed her beer, wondering. Was the God's Eye near the Trident? So she's thinking that. She's wondering if the God's Eye is near the Trident, because the Trident is where she sent Nymeria away. And so she's making this connection. She doesn't have a map in her head, but she knows, like, I don't know that information, but I know where to find it. If I needed to, mm-hmm. I kind of know that I could probably find out how close those two locations are, right? And she's smart enough to make the connection. That sounds a little bit like my wolf, right? That sounds a little bit like Nymeria. Great pack of wolves, and the one that is a she-bitch from the seventh hell. That, to me, that kind of gives you this little idea about what you were kind of calling out as this wider view of the world.
Yes. And I also like this passage because she goes on to correct the adults and says, yeah, you're talking about wolves behaving in ways wolves don't do. Wolves don't snatch children out of the arms of their mothers. And I love this because actually wolves, there's stories in the Middle Ages about wolves. And so like this, I think, draws to some degree on them, whether Martin did it explicitly or just because, you know, it's become part of Western culture. But there's one that I've written about, like from my own work from the 9th century. There's a miracle account. And so these are just accounts of the miracles that occurred at a saint shrine. You know, it's a way of the monastic community saying, look, our saint's really powerful. And one of these stories is about how a wolf snatched a little boy, presumably an infant. And it says, like, the villagers were kind of all around. The adults and the children were around at the edge of the village. And the wolf snatches the baby and runs away with it. And it says everyone chases it, but they can't get it. It's only when the mother prays to the saint. And only then, when the wolf crosses into the saint's territory, that is the monastic territory, that suddenly the wolf has to drop the baby unharmed. And, you know, it's one of those things, like, in looking at that account, when I kind of wrote about it, I was like, well, clearly this is not wolf behavior. And so when I read this, I was, you know, really charmed that Aria also knows this is not wolf behavior. This is a story, right? That people want to tell about the wolves, and that it might say something broader about how they, the dangers of the woods or the dangers of the world around them and what you can't control.
Does this stem from the idea that the wolf is really kind of the devil's creature? Like, there are certain animals that you would associate more with the devil.
It could be. It's, the wolf is seen as a dangerous creature for sure. And that even in that early period, there were books about animals. One's called The Physiologus from this period, and it definitely accorded animals with certain sort of traits and understandings of the animals. But definitely, wolves were perceived to be dangerous animals. Definitely.
And of course, the saint, because I was just wondering, like, if the saint has power over the wolf, are we seeing kind of a binary view of the world? Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, there's territory that's divine. There's territory that's demonic. You know, I think that the woods would generally be thought of as sort of like, you know, that's where the devil's creatures reside. You know,
I think the woods is more that the woods is a place of danger because it's uncontrollable. And you can't really keep track of everything in it. And I think that's a kind of a constant problem. I'm not so sure they would say that this, in terms of the saint, that it would be a dichotomy that the saint's land is somehow better than the other land. It's just that the saint, that's where the saint has power. That's where the saint can best intercede, right? And the whole idea behind the saint is the saint isn't actually making this happen. The saint's interceding with God to get God to make it happen.
And in this story, the saint is like dead and gone, but they're praying to the saint. Is that the idea?
Correct. And they were definitely promoting their own saint's cult with the idea of attracting pilgrims and attracting devotion. But also, I think we can read these miracle accounts sometimes as like they have little lessons, right? Other side lessons in addition to the bigger lessons about how one should behave. And I think this also says something about like what it is to be a good mother. I think that would have been appealing too. Like the good mother never gives up. And the good mother, she knows to pray to the saint, that the saint will help her with her child, right? And I think this comes up, right, because Catelyn prays for her own sons later when she knows that they are in danger. And I think that's a similar kind of impulse or idea that also, again, seems medieval without being really medieval at all, because, of course, it's a different religion in the book, a made-up religion. But, you know, I think it draws to some degree on some of those things. And I think it is similar. Like, she's like, I'm going to go through these ritual actions and I'm going to pray to kind of help my children. That's something I can do to help my children.
I think that in this chapter, we see a couple little indications that the world around them is sort of encoded religiously. Like you mentioned, they saw the grave of the child, and there's a little crystal on the grave. And sort of this is their version of a cross, right? That because they're worshiping the seven gods, and of course crystals are a part of that religion. But then this pack that is being rumored is hanging around the God's Eye. And the God's Eye is this sacred island, but it's sacred not because of the faith of the seven. It's sacred because of the old gods. And, of course, that is what connects Arya to the traditions of the north. It's the wolves and all of that. And I think it's interesting that, you know, what is this old woman says? She's a she-bitch from the seventh hell. All right, well, that's part of the religion or the mythology of the faith of the seven hells, right? And so she has a much different perspective on the wolf, right? She knows wolves don't snatch babies. In fact, that's probably my wolf. And I know that Nymeria wouldn't do such a thing. And then so she's encoding the world differently than the people around her. They're encoding the world through faith of the seven, and has a more northern perspective on these things. But then she kind of has this little moment where she's like, I bet you Nymeria wouldn't even remember me. And I do think you get this sense of alienation, like she's been cut off from her father. She's no longer, you know, near her sister, which she probably wouldn't have wanted to be until they were separated. But she's also alienated
from her culture. I mean, I also think that Nymeria comes to mind for her, because probably in Arya's mind, Nymeria would be attracted to a place that was a place of the old gods, right? So yeah, I agree, like, completely. But I think, yeah, part of this is loss of the kind of culture that she's grown up in, the world that she's grown up in. And yeah, I think there is a kind of sense in which when she says, well, would Nymeria remember me? It's almost like, will that world remember me? Like, what was I to that world?
Yeah, she's not the little girl that left Winterfell, right? There's some continuity there, but man, has a lot happened in her life. You know, she's had, like, legit trauma. She's had lessons. She knows the world is a much bigger place. She's learned to kind of see things a little bit more politically than she did before. I think in all of those ways, I do feel like there's something of an innocence lost in her. It's still early in her story, but she's grown up a lot.
Well, that's happened to her in a really fast time. I think like, you get this sense in this chapter that she's still processing it, and she doesn't know where it's taking her. Like, that's another sense where I feel like it's well written as a chapter that's from the point of view of a child, or maybe even early adolescent, like, that she's processing this, but she doesn't have, like, the mental kind of context yet to think about it in the ways maybe an adult would think about it or understand it. Like, she's still putting things together. She's growing up. Yeah.
Right. All right. I've got a question for an expert on the medieval world.
Okay.
All right. So these gold cloaks come to the inn.
Mm-hmm.
And the gold cloak has a ribbon from the queen.
Okay.
Basically, it's what's written on the ribbon is that, you know, by order of the queen, please bring back this kid.
Right.
And they're looking for Gendry. And Yoren has an interesting response. He says, there's laws about this. And so Yoren is appealing to an authority, and the gold cloak guy is appealing to an authority. So then the question is, what is the greater authority? Is it the queen or the law?
This is a good question. I'm not sure I can give you a super satisfying answer, because part of the reason I like this part of the chapter, this particular aspect, is it does feel very medieval. Because without a modern bureaucratic state, enforcement of any kind of law or any kind of will of someone who's governing is much more difficult. And communication is slow. And I think there's a sense in which it's not as clear, perhaps, as, you know, I may be making it out to be in the books, but, and this is probably because I'm reading it from the angle of someone who's an early medieval historian, but there's a sense that there's kind of local custom or local, I wouldn't want to go so far as local law, because that does not seem to be a part of the Game of Thrones world, but sort of like local customs that also sometimes comes into play in the Game of Thrones world, where what decision you make could rest on something like, what have we traditionally done here over time? What have my people from where I am from done traditionally over time? Mm-hmm. What is the king's law? And then the queen, this is quite nebulous. It's the queen, not the king.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's different too. And then in terms of the law, I mean, this is always tricky, and this is something, I mean, it's still the case for us now. There can be written law, but sometimes there are written laws that aren't necessarily practiced anymore. Right. And so what weighs over what? I mean, this is where, you know, huge bodies of jurisprudence are written. But I think in this world, this does seem medieval to me in the sense that there's competing ideas of what is supposed to happen. And I would say the reason my answer is not going to be very satisfactory is I would say I think it's really going to depend on the situation, whether or not the people in that place would think that the queen's, command is overrides the law, or whether people think that the law overrides what the queen wants. I think it would depend on that local situation.
Yeah. Where is the greater social pressure?
Yeah. And I think this is something, there have been some early medieval historians who've done some really great work on how justice is meted out in the early Middle Ages. And they've noted that sometimes it can seem quite odd to modern people, because it might not seem like justice is meted out in a way that we would expect, like, okay, all murders must be pursued to their bitter end. But they say it's much more about, instead of an ideal of like all murder is terrible and must be absolutely punished. And I should add here that early medieval people in Europe who were Christian definitely understood murder to be wrong and would have thought all murders were wrong. But the question is, how far do you pursue the murderer or what happens?
Right.
That part of this is like, how do you keep peace within a community? It's not that there's a difference between keeping peace within a community sometimes and an abstract sense of justice, and that this can be a kind of tricky thing. And that sometimes when we look at like, how did justice work out on the ground and try to understand why, one way of understanding that is what would have kept peace at that moment. And I think in this scene, what we're seeing is the gold cloaks come and they think people should just listen to us and listen to the queen. But there's enough people around, right, that who are saying no. I mean, they all kind of stand, like, I'm not sure they stand up, but they take a stand, I should say.
Yeah.
Right. And say, no, we're going to defend Gendry. Right. You can't take him. And I think in that sense, that's what's overriding, is that that community at that moment, they've made a decision about what is important. Mm. And that may be the overriding matter here. And that's what tips the decision. But in another situation, that queen's order could have been much more powerful.
Yeah, I'm wondering if, I mean, I guess if you were going to be sort of really reductive, you could say, well, who's got the bigger sword? You know, who has the bigger army, right?
Well, and even like, you can have like a group of armed men and feel very powerful. But in the end, if you make all the people under you unhappy, is that actually going to work out for you in the long run? In some cases, no. Right. You might want to kind of keep a kind of sense of peace in the community. And I think that's also part of it. Are you playing a long game or a short game?
And I think that I didn't really connect this until I heard you explain. But I think a lot of these guys are from Flea Bottom. Right.
Yeah. And
so there's this historic tension between the Gold Cloaks and the men of Flea Bottom.
Absolutely.
And so it's sort of like a cops and robbers kind of situation.
Yeah.
So it's not like they really care about defending Gendry as so much as they think, well, maybe they do. Maybe they think he's one of ours. We know the men of Flea Bottom, and we are as thick as thieves, and we don't trust Gold Cloaks just generally. Right.
Yeah. And also, I don't think they have any love for the queen. I mean, this is harder, I think, to say, like, right at this point in the book. But if we were to look ahead, I mean, Tyrion is definitely critical of Cersei for not paying attention to the needs of just average people in King's Landing. And it's like Tyrion, I think, has a better sense across this book.
Oh, absolutely.
Of, like, what needs to be done. And, like, he gets that you have to play a longer game. And she's just so contemptuous. So I also can't picture, I mean, there are cases of medieval queens who, you know, were beloved and were known for doing amazing things, right, for the poor, for example. Like, I'm thinking of Elizabeth of Hungary. But, that is so not Cersei, right? And so I also think that it's not just the Gold Cloaks. They're just like, that queen, really? You know, why would we care about her, what she says?
In Tyrion's chapter, he notices that these vendors of Flea Bottom are roasting rats and selling rats.
Yes.
Because Cersei has, not only have they been taxed, people have been taxed on their way into the city, but there's no food. Once they get to the city, there's no food because Cersei has decided she's going to protect the people by letting them into the walls. She's not going to feed the people. And so it very well could be that decision is felt and has sort of some wider repercussions.
And we definitely see how food drives people in this chapter. And I mean, across these two chapters. And really, I would say across Clash of Kings. To me, that's, you know, always felt like kind of a theme of it is in the background is the effects of war on people who don't make the wars.
Right. Right. Notable introductions in this chapter. We are introduced to Prayed. I think that's how you say his name.
That's how I would say it too.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
And notable departures, we say goodbye to Praed.
Yes.
So he's introduced, and then he just dies in his sleep. Book differences here. I think this is pretty well represented on the show. I just feel like the setting is different. Like, I think this happens kind of on the road, the encounter with the Gold Cloaks, or at least the initial encounter. It's not at the inn, and you don't have all of the, you know, the bathing and Arya digging into a recently baked pie or whatever. Otherwise, I feel like the show kind of captured this chapter pretty well.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think the show captured definitely the spirit of it well. I think they just simplified the setting. Mm-hmm. And by simplifying the setting, it meant fewer actors, less mm-hmm. time spent on it. But I think it captured the kind of feel of it. There's fewer characters in the show than you get in the book. But I think that's across the whole series and book series. So
yes.
Yeah, I thought it captured well. And they definitely lifted some of the dialogue straight from the chapter.
Right.
Which is quite nice sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I will note that, like, for instance, I guess, like, there's this character, Tarbor, and we're told that Tarbor throws acorns over Praed's body when they bury him, thinking, like, maybe an oak will grow up to kind of commemorate their fallen brother. That would be the kind of thing that you really need a book that's 700 pages to kind of include that kind of detail. That's not going to
exactly
not going to make it in the show. But I was going to say, even though we're not introduced to him in the chapter, we learn his name, and that is Jaqen H'ghar. You know, we've seen him before in Arya's previous chapter, but he kind of introduces himself to Arya more robustly in this chapter, and we know he's going to become an important mentor for her along the way.
Yeah, and I think it's an interesting introduction in the sense that, like, something that struck me on rereading the chapter before this talk was his physical description, which I think I hadn't, I don't know, picked up under notice the previous time I read the chapter. His appearance sounds kind of frightening or strange, right? And I thought, oh, wow, that she ends up deciding eventually that he's to be trusted to some degree. Uh-huh. This makes it even more interesting, but it's like, I don't know. It's a good description in the book. I think in the show, that's always a difference too for me from the show, from the books, is that in the show, they kind of tone down some of the more extreme kinds of appearance that Martin describes.
Yeah, I think with Martin,
you know, across the book.
Yeah, Martin loves colors. I think his view of the medieval world is that there are characters that are going to be like, I have like bright blue dyed beards, and you know, they're shaped into a trident. And Jaqen H'ghar in this iteration, you know, half of his hair is white and the other half is red, and he's got a great nose, and he speaks a little bit like Cyril Farrell, which Arya notes, like, it's the same, but it's a little different as well. Like, she's really observing him and trying to make a decision about who he is.
Boy. Lovely boy.
What do you want?
A man has a thirst. A man does not drink for a day in the night. A boy could make a friend.
I have friends.
Drink this beer before I skin you.
A man does not choose his companions. These two, they have no courtesy. A man must ask forgiveness. You're called Ari. This man has the honor to be Jaqen H'ghar, once of the free city of Lorath.
But I think in general, the show will tend to tone down those colors.
Yeah. It's also, I think, you know, with the appearance of the Targaryens and Tyrion, you know, those are the two, I think, classic cases. But, and I think part of that is to make it palatable to, you know, a TV audience. But also, I think it's like, it's too difficult in some cases to, you know, make a human appear this way, right? And so it may not be worth it to the showrunners. Like, so I'm affected here by my colleague that I taught the class with, who Jeff Chown, who teaches about long form television. And he and I would often, some of the best things in the class would be him and I discussing why certain things happened. And I would often say, well, you know, in the Middle Ages, and he would say, well, a TV budget.
Right. Yes, yes, yes.
And so I think budget is always part of it too. And I think You know, that also sometimes accounts for some of the simplification. It's narrative, but it's also sometimes it has to do with the finances of the mm-hmm. show.
Let me ask you this. All right, so Martin's view specifically of, and you see this like with the tournaments and whatnot, his view mm-hmm. of these knights is that they're very colorful. Like they've got yeah. banners, and that, you know, some of their helmets are shaped in certain ways, and, you know, bright plumes, and you almost get this, and the horses are clothed in bright colors as well. You get the sense when you're reading the book that Martin views these tournaments as a very colorful affair. And then, of course, on the show, everything's a little bit more muddy. Everything's a little bit more dull. Everything's a little bit more, you know, steel and leather. And I'm wondering, is Martin getting that from stories from the Middle Ages, or is he getting that with, like, I'm just wondering if this is kind of an anachronism on his part, or if knights in the real world would have been so colorful.
I think it's actually in the kind of real world of the Middle Ages, it would have been mixed. Definitely, it's certainly in the late Middle Ages, I think tournaments were quite colorful affairs. And I mean, we wouldn't want to say some of the descriptions that Martin has, especially in the books, of really super elaborate helmets and things like that. Some of that we don't really see so much in the Middle Ages. And this is where I think Martin has a great historical pastiche, because he really pulls from so many different time periods right. and kind of puts it all together. So in that sense, no, like his description of the tournaments in the books is never going to be a perfect for the Middle Ages. But yeah, I would still argue that, especially in the late Middle Ages, a tournament would have been a pretty colorful, exciting place. But I think it also would have been really muddy.
Yeah, of course.
And really, you know, so, and I think, like, in the terms of the show, to me, it feels like it's the kind of, like, Game of Thrones really draws on, like, this depiction of pseudo-medieval warfare as gritty that we see in a lot of other recent films. It's different from like older films, I would think. So for example, like I think a contrast that is kind of a classic one to draw is the difference between Laurence Olivier's Henry V and Kenneth Branagh's. Where Kenneth Branagh, like, it's a post Vietnam War movie. It doesn't show warfare in the same way.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's a much more gritty kind of realistic kind of warfare. In the same sense that, like, you know, some of the post Vietnam war movies of other eras are also shown to be more gritty. So I do wonder, and I'm not going to say like this is like a conscious choice necessarily on the part of the showrunners. Might have been an unconscious choice. But I think in a sense, it's more what a modern audience would expect.
I see.
That if it's too bright yes. and too pretty, that a modern audience is not going to buy it as something real.
Yeah.
Then it's too fantastical. It's too fantasy, yeah, you know, maybe.
I think you're right. And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
I do see her as a protagonist, but I see her as there's clearly more to this. There's, look, man, this is the Game of Thrones we're talking about here. There is no rules on the back of the box.
You know what? This entire, I wrote two books about Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. And I took over this podcast, and this was all a big long con to get you to watch the show with me. And at this moment, the moment where you said, this is the Game of Thrones, man, there's no rules on the back of the box, I feel like I win. I feel like this has all been worth it.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car?
Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
I want to ask you about Otto, one of the characters that you identified in your notes as someone who is kind of interesting and might have a historical parallel is Otto. And he seems to be one of, like, you know, he's kind of the big mover and shaker of the show. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Otto.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he was interesting, you know, his position. I mean, he's obviously the power behind the throne, isn't he?
Yeah.
But I mean, he's from a kind of lesser family, certainly not from one of the great families, I don't think. He's a younger son, so, you know, he wouldn't have been one to normally or naturally succeed. So his advancement in Westerosi politics comes down to the fact that he has that position. And then the fact that he's having been Han for more than one king, he then increasingly becomes that kind of trusted, respected figure, doesn't he? But I think it does reflect that example of families on the rise, you know, families who are able to make something of themselves due to service at court rather than through inheritance or succession. And I think that's quite interesting to see because, yeah, in my own studies, I suppose, that there is comparison with medieval Scotland, particularly in the 15th century. You see a sequence of royal successions which are interrupted by royal minorities. So successive 15th century Scottish monarchs succeed as youngsters. And so there are periods of minority government. Mm-hmm. And in each of those, you see families kind of rising to the top quickly. Families which have been prominent or perhaps not quite as prominent at court, seizing their opportunity in a period where there is no obvious seat of power, and seizing control of the king, because that gives them that authority. It allows them to do things and to wield power and to grant lands and make themselves important in a way that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. So you've got the Crichtons and the Livingstons during the minority of James II, the Boys during the minority of James III, all of whom rise fast and enjoy their moment in the sun. But as soon as those kings reach the majorities, turn on them and they fall just as quickly thereafter. So I suppose my not having read the book on which the series is based, I'll be interested to see if Otto follows that kind of trajectory.
As someone who studies this professionally, were you watching the show at any moment and thinking, oh, that's obviously anachronistic?
I thought that the dragons rather obviously, but not for the obvious reason of there not being dragons. I just thought it was really interesting, those latter episodes where Daemon and Rhaenyra are, you know, strategizing. They're talking about where they can move their troops, how they can besiege potentially King's Landing. But the key tactic for them is the use of the dragons, that they have more of them. And of course, there's nothing of that kind of status of super weapon in medieval warfare.
Right.
So you don't have a comparison. I think it's far more like the very modern idea of, you know, an aircraft carrier group or a tactical nuclear weapon or something.
You're right. I think Martin has said that the dragons kind of do represent something like a nuclear bomb or something. Right.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's a bringing in of a modern concept into the ancient world.
Yeah, very much so. So I think in a military context, then it is, and we saw that in Game of Thrones as well. You know, warfare is fought out in a pretty normal, standardized way until Daenerys rocks up in Westeros with her dragons, and then it all goes to hell. You know, you get Jaime's forces just utterly destroyed by one dragon, but because they have that kind of impact and that ability. So yes, that's something that's completely out of kilter with how you might assume the depiction of warfare is, because the rest of the time it is, you know, knights and swords and
ships
and that type of thing. And ships. Oh, yeah, and ships, yeah. And actually, that is quite a nice one, because the naval part of medieval warfare is one of the kind of understudied bits, or the bit that often gets forgotten about. So, so yes, the movement of men by sea and fighting at sea is certainly interesting. I think that the dragons also, though, completely upset the balance of power politically, don't they? You know, the Targaryens are on the throne, and there has been that massive era of peace and an uninterrupted Targaryen succession because of the dragons, because nobody can stand against them because they have access to dragons and nobody else does. And so you get that idea of an eon-spanning Targaryen reign, which again wouldn't be the case. You have long reigning dynasties in the Middle Ages, but certainly nothing like that. And that's because dynasties are always challenged, and dynasties also die out. You know, there are always accidents of birth and death which interrupt things. And obviously you have that in the House of the Dragon, but they just solve it by going back to further up the Targaryen line, and so it's fine. That's how you have Viserys' own succession. But in historical cases, it doesn't tend to work that way, or it doesn't often work that way.
So I didn't ask you this ahead of time because I just got this email. It's a question. And I think that I can answer this okay, but I want to see if maybe you can help me answer this question. This is a question from DW. Can you find one of your amazing guests? That's you, Ian. You're one of my amazing guests. To talk about where the idea of a dragon came from. What's the origin of dragons in the real world? It seems that many cultures have an idea of a winged beast or other mythical beasts. How did houses get associated with dragons? So this kind of overlaps a little bit with my own research of the ancient world. So I'll just go ahead and start this, and maybe you can help me with the medieval period. So it kind of depends on where you want to start, because this idea comes out of China, and it also comes out of Egypt. So in Egypt, you've got this chaos monster named Apep, and he's more like a giant snake. And then out of China, you've got the idea, the same word for dragon is the same word for crocodile. So the mythology kind of comes out of these animals that you might meet by the river, in both cases.
Right.
In Egypt, Apep is a chaos monster. In China, the dragon almost represents like a storm beast, or, you know, it's kind of a symbol for the balance of weather, really. And in the Ming Dynasty, we have dragons being used as sigils. We see depictions of rulers with a dragon sigil on their robe. But my guess, and you can help me with this, is that probably medieval Britain borrows dragon imagery from the Bible. The Book of Revelation has a dragon mentioned. My guess is that their interest in biblical mythology is more of the source for the dragons in that period.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, I think, yeah, the allusion to dragons being linked to the devil, and such, and to kind of evil generally, I think is perhaps where it comes from. And then you have the development of that with, you know, saintly tales like St. George slaying the dragon, and the popularity of those types of saints, and then the use of those types of saints within kind of national myth building. You know, it means that the dragon then finds representation in medieval art, and in medieval church art perhaps particularly, quite commonly, especially in somewhere like England with the pickup of the development of St. George as a national saint. You know, you have that representation in a popular context, and so you see it quite often, I think. But yeah, I think absolutely a biblical beginning for it.
In Revelation, the dragon is just forthrightly called the devil, right? Mm. So, and I think at this point, I don't know if there's a clear idea of like a winged beast with legs and, you know, serpentine body or whatever. But at times you do see kind of something that looks more like how we imagine dragons in these medieval bestiaries.
Yeah, I think those kind of bestiary depictions are direct. You know, that is where later artists and authors, I think, take their lead from, because, you know, the bestiary depictions of animals are famously not all that accurate.
No.
But then by and large, over the centuries, we've worked that out and had better depictions of such things provided. Whereas, mm-hmm. of course, dragons take the form they do because they're replicated, because there isn't the real world example to copy. So their development probably is quite early, and then it kind of retains that form through much of history. I suppose it's interesting, though, what you're saying about them having perhaps different forms in a different global context, you know, that in a that idea of a Chinese context being quite different in terms of what it looks like and the form it takes.
Yeah, we see like ancient descriptions and like Egyptian and Babylonian texts. We have some carvings that you can find in Iran, temples and things like that. And I do think that the Egyptian mythology does absolutely inform the biblical ideology about this.
Right.
There is something about the idea of like throwing back the chaos. You're looking forward to the end of time when chaos is no more. And so the metaphor of a dragon is very much... And I don't know, like, if you think about where Martin gets his influence, there is a sense in which the dragon is meant to balance out the weather. You know, he's got these two major magical elements of his world building. It's the seasons are weird. And then the dragons are meant to battle the creatures of winter, right? So, but I mean, I think that for the most part, in House of the Dragon, there is something to the fact that Daemon is something of a creature of chaos.
Yeah.
Right? So he's the most dragonish guy on the show, and he happens to be the most chaotic and warlike, whereas Viserys has kind of like partitioned himself off from the dragons. He almost doesn't like the idea of being associated with dragons. And he's the king of peace. So I think that there is something about that ancient concept of dragons that informs these characters.
I suppose as well, the kind of chaotic aspect of it is what plays out right at the end of the series as well, isn't it? That because I think you've maybe been lulled into a sense of thinking that these dragons are controlled and
yep.
controllable, but that those final scenes very
yeah,
much
no,
demonstrate
they're
the chaos or not.
Chaos
yeah.
monsters, you know, they're either chaos monsters or they're just engines of war, right? So
yeah,
they're going to do what dragons do, and I think Viserys calls that out in the first episode. He says, we should have never messed with them.
Yeah.
There's a mythology that we control these dragons. In reality, I think what he's saying is they're going to lead us to war.
But then you have Daemon saying we need to get more dragons.
Yeah,
we need to get these wild dragons and tame them. And that way leads, you know, chaos and catastrophe.
That's right. But of course, for a second son, it absolutely is his way to distinguish himself. You know, he's a dragon rider, and if you go to war, he gets to show his mettle.
Yeah.